This is ReachMD. This PROVA education activity is titled Insomnia and Comorbidity, High Risk with Poor Outcomes. It is supported by an independent medical educational grant from Merck. The following is a live lecture recorded at From Guidelines to Practice, Managing Challenging Cases in Primary Care in Pasadena, California. Prior to beginning the activity, please be sure to review the faculty disclosure statements as well as the learning objectives. Your presenter is Dr. Larry Culpepper, Professor of Medicine of Family Practice at Boston University.
I really want to take you through an understanding of sleep, what it is, and I'm going to answer a question for you that, or at least partly answer a question that has puzzled us for ages, which is, why do we sleep? We're also going to look at three cases, particularly looking at the intersection of insomnia and comorbid medical disease. So I'm going to take three cases, one focused on cardiovascular, another on diabetes, and a third on depression, and really look at the interaction of insomnia and those chronic conditions. So, if you've got a patient with a chronic medical condition sitting in front of you, what's the likelihood that they have insomnia? They often are complaining about musculoskeletal, but look at the frequency of cardiovascular disease, which may be silent. The other, flipping that, if you have a patient with a medical condition in front of you, what's the likelihood that they have insomnia? And then the number of conditions, as we go up to four, it more than doubles from just one condition, up to about 40%. So 40 to 60% of patients with chronic insomnia have a considerable hereditable influence on that. When we look at mechanism, we find autonomic and CNS arousal, hyperarousal, is a very common final pathway. It's what we now understand is we have two systems in the brain. One basically increases the sleep drive throughout the day. The other is a drive to stay awake. The reticular activating system is a key component of that. And what happens is that drive is on a circadian rhythm. That can be out of balance. It can be uncoordinated. You know, it may be that it's a failure of the wake-promoting drive to decrease in the evening. Yeah, it was only about the late 1990s that orexin was identified, first time, in the brain, and it turns out to be a key component, a key driver of the arousal system. And what we find is that arousal system involves a number of brain areas. I'm not going to go through them, but they keep the cortex aroused and alert. Best approach is to think of insomnia as having a significant component of dysfunction in the arousal system. Now, when we evaluate a patient, is the duration of sleep important? Well, it actually turns out to be quite important. When you have objective short sleep, that is a real marker for the genetic predisposition. It tends to be unremitting and chronic, and it goes along very much with basal brain activity. We see glucose, cortisol, ACTH levels altered. When I approach a patient, I want to diagnose insomnia, but I also want to keep in mind my assessment. So I want to know, is it acute? Is it chronic? Were there any precipitating events? Is it nightly? Is it intermittent? Is it only during the work week? Is it only on weekends? When during the night? Is it onset problems that just can't turn their mind off and go to sleep? Or is it early morning awakening? I wake up too early, just can't stay asleep, and I don't feel rested. And how severe is it? We don't have a sleep tab to put them in, but certainly we can get a sense of severity in terms of self-report. And then importantly, what's the impact on function? Other things we want to think about, expectations, preferences, what medical comorbidities and medications might be an influence. You know, if a patient gets up to urinate and then stays awake for an hour, that is insomnia. When we approach treatment, certainly the base that we start from is sleep hygiene, education, CBTI, which we may not be able to get formally, but we can certainly use some of its principles in terms of helping a patient approach their sleep problem, and exercise, which is a critical component. Key with exercise is moderate exercise, but 4 to 5 hours before they go to bed, at least. And the reason for that is you want poor body temperature to come back down, because a cool environment and a cool core body temperature is very helpful in getting a patient to sleep. We then have a number of non-specific treatments, the benzos, the non-benzodiazepines. They tend to act on GABA, which is throughout the CNS and is a suppressant. We also have specific agents, melatonin, histamine antagonists, orexin antagonists, that target that awakening system, are the specific brain centers involved in regulating sleep. CBT works, and it works well, and it has a lasting influence. CBT, it takes a while often for it to kick in, whereas pharmacotherapy will often take effect early, but then doesn't. You get rebound insomnia, which is not rebound to the medication, it's just the insomnia comes back if you've only treated it with pharmacotherapy. So oftentimes we may use both. When we look at the hypnotics, the benzos, non-benzos, they use GABA, which is an inhibitory agent. That is a broad effect on the brain. It's taking a sledgehammer to the entire brain. But it works, and patients know it. Remeltion works. It's not used very often, but what we find is after 3 to 4 weeks, it really kicks in for some patients, and particularly if patients have circadian problems, it may be useful. It certainly is benign in terms of side effects. The antidepressants, we really have two in this class, trazodone, which we often use off-label, and one that I'll show you in a minute that actually has an FDA indication, but there are other ways to get it. So trazodone, certainly H1 antihistamine at low dose is key. Also has an alpha-1 antagonist effect. That may be useful for nightmares, PTSD. 68 hours half-life, so it does last through the night. Problem is we don't have studies on this that go beyond about 2 weeks, so we're not real certain if this preparation really has a long-term effect on sleep. Doxepin, low dose, is a pure H1 antihistamine. We think of it as an SSRI, and in 1982, it was one of the major branded antidepressants, but it was very sedating. What we find is at 3 to 6 milligrams, it's a very effective for insomnia, particularly for sleep maintenance insomnia and keeping people asleep throughout the night, you know, into the next morning. There also is no head-to-head comparison in the literature between the 3 to 6 milligram branded approach and the 10 milligram dose. So I leave that for your consideration. Orexin antagonists are fairly new, and there's one that's on the market now. There are a number of these in development that you're going to see coming out over the next few years, I expect. And what they do is very specifically affect the sleep mechanisms. So these really are the most directly effective at targeting the sleep control mechanism. So suvorexin, it suppresses, it inhibits orexin. And in doing so, it inhibits the alerting system in the brain. So it's a very specific to the sleep system. It doesn't change your sleep profile. So if we look at REM sleep and we look at different stages of sleep, they all increase as patients improve their insomnia. Let's look at the first cardiovascular patient. This is a 39-year-old accountant. Think about it. He's doing your taxes, okay? Approach it from that perspective. He comes in for hypertension follow. He's been Benzoprine, Pril, with good control in the past, but recently it's not been keeping his blood pressure in shape. He's got some stressors in his life, and in reviewing it, he also reports that, yes, he's having more difficulty sleeping. So he goes to bed at 11, gets up at 6:30, so that's 7.5 hours potential sleep. Takes him an hour to get to sleep, so that's down to 6.5 hours. And now he's often waking up at 5 a.m., so he's not able to stay asleep throughout the night, and he doesn't feel good the next day. It really is having an effect. He's having difficulty focusing and concentrating, but it's only been going on for a few months. And that's key. This is acute onset. There's the stressors involved. If you look, family history, yeah, he's got some red flags in terms of cardiovascular. He does have some arterial or narrowing and is borderline, you know, overweight, obese. So how is insomnia associated with hypertension? What they found is that those that developed insomnia over time were twice as likely to go on and develop hypertension. Go beyond hypertension. How about cardiovascular risk? These are all national registry studies. So Taiwan, Sweden, Norway, they all have national registries. So they can track their entire population over years. And these are prospective follow-up studies that are done that way. What we find is that acute MIs go up by 70%, stroke goes up by 80 to 90%. First cardiovascular events, under that is men and women in both genders, they go up 30 to 40%. When we look at congestive heart failure, the number of insomnia symptoms increases. Your likelihood of then going on later to develop congestive heart failure. How about contributing to mortality, cardiovascular mortality? There are a number of studies here, large federally funded studies reported in Circulation a couple of years ago. Those with difficulty initiating and are reporting non-restorative sleep had a 55% increase in total mortality per year over the follow-up, and specifically cardiovascular mortality increased by about 30%. Moving to treatment, well, the first thing is do no harm. And what we find is that big impact on whether beta blockers get into the brain. So when we get down to the beta selective and then to atenolol and bisoprolol, which do not cross the blood-brain barriers because they're low lipidicity as well, they have marked decreased likelihood of contributing to new insomnia. If we treat insomnia, is it going to help blood pressure? Hypnotic actually does decrease both diastolic and systolic blood pressure. It's particularly impactful when the insomnia improves. So let's come back to this 39-year-old. We assess him. He's got a recent onset. It's frequent. He's having onset and early morning awakening. He's got some recent stressors. He is down in a pretty significant range. Severity is 5 to 6 hours subjectively. And he'd like medication. That's a preference. He just doesn't have time for the CBT. So if we approach him in terms of treatment, his new insomnia to him. So sleep hygiene is going to be pretty important to think through. Getting him to exercise can be very helpful. It's very augmenting in terms of sleep. Moderate use of alcohol, calories, particularly later in the evening, is critical. The old idea of, hey, I'll have a glass of wine, it'll put me to sleep. Yeah, it'll put you to sleep, but 3 or 4 hours later, it's going to wake you up. And that's the problem, particularly when he has early onset. So that's certainly something to emphasize. Exploring catastrophizing. Oh, my God, I'm not asleep. I'm going to mess up tomorrow. I got to get to sleep. That type of catastrophizing sets in for a lot of patients and is one of the foci of CBT. So explain to him that, yes, you're going to feel drowsy, but you know, objectively, your performance doesn't decrease that much, you know, with just one night of lost sleep. It's really the chronic cumulative effect that's critical. Epworth Sleepiness Scale, you may not have seen it, but Google it. It's a simple chart, few questions that really helps you gauge the severity of a sleep problem. Yes, things like, you know, how long does it take you to fall asleep if you're just sitting in a quiet room reading, or do you fall asleep watching TV, or do you fall asleep, you know, at a red light, you know, as you drive home. That's kind of a red flag for severe insomnia. So it's useful. Sleep diary may be helpful. I use these both to find out more about it myself, but also to get patients involved in thinking about their sleep. You know, for in terms of treatment, we want something short-term. So I might, you know, this might be a place where I might use a short-term benzodiazepine, non-benzodiazepine. Also might use a doxepin since it, does have a good impact in terms of the early awakening, which the non-benzodiazepines, that's problematic in terms of half-life. Having something that stays effective, you know, 6-8 hours into the night, but doesn't wipe out the next morning in terms of over. Let's move to diabetes. 34-year-old, sixth grader, teacher comes in. Family history of diabetes. It's a little worrisome, overweight, and finds herself irritable, wants to lose weight. You know, she's concerned about the diabetes. She's tired all the time. Getting further sleep history, she goes to bed a little bit before 11, alarms at 6, so 7 hours and change in terms of possible sleep, but she takes an hour to get to sleep, so that's down to, you know, 6 hours or so. And then she wakes and stays awake for at least an hour. So we're down in that 5-hour range. And it's been chronic since college. So, you know, she's just sort of accepted. It's just her lot in life. But it really is dragging her down at this point. And on the weekends, she does compensate some for it, but that by itself is not adequate. There's no report of snoring or apneic events by bed partners, so we are thinking of other potential diagnoses. So again, is it associated? So objective sleep markedly increases, threefold increase in your likelihood of having diabetes. So this is cross-sectional, not cause-effect. We don't sleep well, we don't eat well. So lifestyle intervention advice is helpful, but this just is the impact that we worsen our diets, just behavioral. That active duty military study should more than twofold increase. It doesn't matter if you look by age. Insomnia, chronic insomnia, precedes and leads to development of diabetes. We look at mechanisms. Well, insulin resistance is altered for the worse in those with insomnia, particularly if they have daytime sleepiness, which is a good indicator of severity, 80%. When a Japanese company looked at their annual checkup data, what they found was the difficulty maintaining a sleep and early morning awakening markedly increased diabetes. So in the range of 2-4, almost 7-fold increase in diabetes. Back to our 34-year-old school teacher. She's got chronic insomnia. It's been there, it's been part of her life since college. She complains of being tired, but not, I can't sleep. Most nights, onset and middle of the night, so she needs something to start, you know, and to keep her to sleep. She's not exercising, so that's something we're going to kick in. Just start out, you know, 5 minutes more walking. Let's move it up to 10 minutes, 15 minutes can be very helpful. Education, again, catastrophizing, sleepiness scale, sleep diary may be helpful in terms of letting her monitor sleep as well as you. Here's a patient with chronic insomnia. So I don't want to put her on a benzo. She's tried the OTCs and has already encountered the side effects. You know, diphenhydramine, the problem with it, it's still in, you know, in your brain 16 hours later, knocking you out during the next day when you're trying to be alert and active. So it's a big downfall. It also has a number of side effects. I would be looking at something that is going to be targeting specific sleep mechanism. We've got the sense she wakes up, she keeps alert, she keeps thinking. She's not turning her brain off at night. So she needs something to dampen the wakening drive. And that's where suvorexant, doxepin, as FDA-indicated treatments may be effective. Trazodone, if you look at the American College of Physicians recommendations, they certainly don't use it first line. Suvorexant here is probably the most specific again, and I definitely would want to get her into a CBT-like intervention if possible. So let's move on. Third case. So this 55-year-old painter says, my life's turning gray again. He's had multiple episodes of depression, and it's back. No real new stressors, and that's very frequent. But insomnia and sleep problems may be interactive with that onset. So it's been an escitalopram maintenance therapy, and he's noticing his flags for depression. That's why he's in your office, which is decreased innervation, energy. He's amotivated, having trouble concentrating, focusing, and he's having difficulty sleeping again. And he's found that's a real concern because that often is part of the program. He is really getting down in that 5-6 hour range of sleep. It's persistent. Further assessment is chronic, recurrent with depressive episodes. Most nights, 5 hours sleep, middle of the night, and early awakening. So that's often a very common pattern with depression. Yeah, he's tried his wife's praise the lamb. It worked. He liked it. You know, he wants some, you know, for himself. You know, he's willing to take your advice. And we see he's got really no nocturnal concerns. You know, doesn't exercise regularly. This is looking at the study. 3.5-year follow-up, no psychiatric disorder at baseline, insomnia at baseline. And what we see is from, you know, those that continued not to have insomnia, only 5% of them became depressed. And that bumps up to 6-fold increase up to 31%. Who develops insomnia in relation to their mental health history? This was a study of New Zealanders, about 1,000 New Zealanders, born in 72, 73. and they're still being followed. You know, so this is a long-term follow-up starting at birth. When we look at insomnia at age 35 and then look back at psychiatric histories that have been accessed repeatedly in this population over time, starting at age 5, what we find is that patients that develop insomnia had family histories of depression and anxiety and had lifelong episodes of depression and anxiety, particularly beginning in childhood. Depression and anxiety tends to lead to chronic insomnia. Overall, as we look over the lifespan, anxiety disorders, which tend to be fairly chronic, often precede the insomnia. They will very likely contribute to the insomnia, but they precede the insomnia. Does insomnia alter the course of depression? What we find is that those with persistent insomnia, those that continue to have sleep difficulty, were much more likely to remain depressed. Depressed patients or anxious patients that also had insomnia, you're going to see them in the office a lot more commonly. 2 to 3 times more visits to us, and the insomnia may still be hidden, or we may just consider it part of the depression. But it's a comorbid condition. Needs to be focused on separately in addition to the depression. And it certainly has its impairment in terms of work and activity. Now, the key here is that you need to treat both. And there have been a number of studies now that show that if you have a depressed patient and they have insomnia, yeah, and that should be part of the baseline assessment. If you treat both of them from the get-go, so you start treatment for both, you know, at the same time, and you look down the line, you know, in terms of the depression status, 3 months later, 6 months later, they're more likely to be in remission from depression than if you take a consecutive approach. The latest, the DSM-5, and the latest insomnia guidelines around diagnosis or treatment categories eliminate primary insomnia from the vocabulary, secondary insomnia from the vocabulary. They're comorbid conditions. They need to be treated at the same time. When we look at choice of antidepressant, we certainly do know that there are sedating antidepressants, and certainly paroxetine will cause daytime somnolence. Mirtazapine at low doses will cause daytime somnolence. Sometimes we use that in terms of selecting that to help patients get to sleep. But overall, there's no systematic effect on insomnia as opposed to daytime somnolence. So Zolpidem certainly improves the insomnia, but it really doesn't augment the antidepressant effect. When we look at suicidality, patients with sedative hypnotic use have a significant increase after adjusting for our insomnia. This is certainly an issue to consider in terms of hypnotics and non-benzodiazepine use in depressed patients. So let's go back to our 55-year-old house painter. He's got chronic insomnia. It's a co-traveler with this depression. It's onset, it's middle of the night, and it's early morning awakening. He does have the impact in at 5 hours. Now, his depression's already doubling his likelihood of diabetes and cardiovascular disease and other chronic conditions. Throw insomnia on top of that, and he's at marked risk for increase in those chronic conditions. He's tried over TCs, tossed them out. He likes his wife's alprazolam, he'd like that. He's not exercising regularly, and so again, encourage exercise. This is, again, a patient I would stay away from benzos on. So he wants a benzo, I don't want him on a benzo. Again, suvorexant, doxepin, they're both going to help with the early morning awakening. They are both very helpful at that range. They don't have the marked knockout effect that the benzos have, which he really liked, in terms of onset, but they are effective at onset. Now, I find that antihistaminics tend to decrease, particularly their onset effect, with time. There's an accommodation to that development of tolerance in terms of putting the patients to sleep at the beginning of the night, but the early morning awakening effect does continue long term. So doxepin certainly would be a reasonable recommendation for him. Suvorexant, again, because of the chronic nature of his condition and the specific targeting, would be very useful. And again, I would emphasize, it has a much more gentle, totally different effect in terms of putting people to sleep, taking half an hour or so before bedtime, and it does significantly cut down on onset insomnia. But it doesn't have the psychic knockout effect that the benzos have. Summary, chronic condition. It's not a wastebasket diagnosis. Particularly important is significant insomnia, particularly if it's subjective, and you can often see that just with the hours that they report being in bed and not being awake. Treating it is something to think about doing coterminous with the treatment of those conditions. You know, it's a comorbidity, it's not a primary or secondary thing. And pharmacotherapy, you need to select pharmacotherapy in keeping with the chronicity and the pattern of insomnia and the expected duration of treatment. If you're using it like in our very first case where short-term insomnia problem, hopefully we can quickly get that patient back to sleeping well. That's where non-benzohypnotic might be valuable. Other than that, I would tend to stay away from those.
The preceding activity was sponsored by Prova Education. To receive your free CME credits or to download this segment, go to reachmd.com/prova. This is CME on ReachMD. Be part of the knowledge.